Station number 11315, Rule 1.
Mr. Young, Reel 1, could you tell me, first of all, where you were born and something about your family background, please?
Well, I was born, actually enough to my disappointment and sadness, in England. I was born just outside Stratford-upon-Avon.
Why were you sad to be born in England?
Well, look at this.
You're really a Scotsman, are you?
But I went to Scotland when I was, I was 4, and lived in Scotland from then onwards until such time as I came to London in 1924 as a journalist, as a reporter, to join the editorial staff of the London Evening News, the greatest evening paper in the world at that time.
What had your father done for a living? What had your father done for a living?
What did he do?
Yes.
Oh, he was. He started work when he was the age, when he was 6, as a gardener, a gardener's boy. And then he worked in all kinds of jobs, the whiskey business, and then eventually we ended up in Scotland. As I say, at the age of 4, when in Scotland.
What are your memories of the First World War?
Very vivid memories, because, as I say, I was a schoolboy in Edinburgh, and I can remember the first day of the war, when war was declared. We went down. My father took me out. And we went to the King's Park in Edinburgh, just by Arthur's Seat. And there, I think it was the 9th Royal Scots, were drilling. And to my surprise, I saw among them being drilled several of my oldest schoolmates, 18-year-old, who had immediately joined up. And they'd just come back from the OTC camp, and they were drilling in our uniform, in our OTC uniform. And that was my start to the first day of the war in Edinburgh.
We hear that at the outbreak of the First World War, there was public euphoria and enthusiasm. Did you see anything of that in Edinburgh?
Oh, there was tremendous enthusiasm. Perhaps enthusiasm is not the right word. Is not an appropriate word. It was a determination rather than enthusiasm. And, of course, the thing was that there was this great rush to the recruiting offices for the young men of Edinburgh to join, of course, in that case, most of them were joining the Royal Scots. And the elite regiment battalion to get into was the 9th Royal Scots, which was always known in Edinburgh as the Dandy Ninth. The Dandy Ninth, because they were the only kilted regiment, kilted battalion, rather, in the Royal Scots.
The others had trews. Did the others have trews?
They were trews. But the Dandy Ninth were a territorial regiment, which was a kilted battalion. And it attracted all the outstanding sporting men of in Edinburgh. That is, all the star rugby players from the leading schools, academicals, Watsonians, Harrieters, all of them. They rushed to join the Royal Scots, the 9th Royal Scots, the Dandy 9th.
Did you see anything of the white feather handing out that was supposed to have taken place in parts of England?
No, not in Scotland, no. There was one very distinguished, I won't mention his name because it's not fair, but there was a very distinguished rugby player, a Scottish rugby international, who took a very firm stand on religious grounds as a conscientious objector. That was the only one that I ever heard of. But certainly the white feather never, never, never was seen in Edinburgh.
Did you see anybody agitating against the war by soapbox orations?
No, nothing like that. It was anything but. The attitude was these Germans had to be stopped. The country was threatened, and the Scots were going to do their damnedest to see that they were repelled and licked.
Did you share those feelings yourself?
Oh, we all did. Of course we did. There was an enormous sort of feeling in the school at the time. It was more of a romantic feeling among the boys of my age. I was what? I suppose I was 13. Yes, 13. And all my sort of schoolmates at that time, it was a romantic undertaking.
Did the mood persist, or did it change?
But that is the point. Gradually, it took a little time to percolate back until you began to realize what the reality of war was. Up to then, it was a romantic affair. We'd seen the Dandy Ninth. I can remember the night clearly. I went with my mother, and we were standing near the Usher Hall in Lothian Road, Edinburgh. And we saw the Dandy Ninth, the cream of Edinburgh's youth, young men, all the sporting men, great figures in Scottish sporting life, in this battalion, marching down the Lothian Road to the Caledonian Station, as it was then, to be entrained to go south and eventually to cross to France to take part in the trench warfare, which was then just beginning.
What was it that specifically brought home the reality of war, do you think?
The first thing that really I can... It's curious that you should ask that question. I can remember the day, the occasion, and exactly where I was when we first real reality of the significance and the horror of the war came home to us boys of my age. It was in 1915, in May 1915. I can remember exactly where I was at school. It's where I was standing in the school, in my school, which was Watson's. The word came that Jamie Pearson, had been killed. Jamie Pearson was the great hero at that time of all we schoolboys. He was a famous Watsonian athlete, played cricket for Watsonians. He was a fine runner, but above all, he played centre three-quarter for Scotland, for the Scottish rugby team. I think he won 10 caps in all.
How do you spell Pearson?
P-E-A-R-S-O-N, Pearson. Jamie Pearson. I looked him up this very day. There he is.
And how did that change public attitude then?
Well, no, I'm not saying it changed the attitude in Edinburgh as a whole, but I'm saying it brought home to a great gathering of schoolboys the real reality of war. We had lost our great hero.
It says in this entry in this book you've given me that his name was James Pearson and that he died the 22nd of May 1915.
That's right.
What else brought home the reality of war? What else brought home the reality of war to you?
That, the death of Jimmy Pearson.
Anything else? Like bombing raids?
Well, yes, because by this time, some of the schoolmates, elder brothers, relatives, friends, were coming home from France wounded. And, of course, we then began to realize that war, the stories they had to tell, their experiences, brought home to those, you know, what the realities of war were, what trench warfare was beginning to look like, the horrors of it. The wet trenches, the, you know, all the awful aspects of war.
Did you get any bombing raids in Edinburgh? Did you get any bombing raids in
Edinburgh? Oh, yes.
What do you remember of them?
Oh, very well. That was in April 1916, when, I don't know whether there was, I can't quite recall whether there was one or two Zeppelins came over Edinburgh. The object of it, their objective, of course, was the Fourth Bridge. But bombs were dropped in Edinburgh, and one has a very realistic memory of it, because I went off to school the next morning, having been up most of the night with my parents. And when I got to the school, I found that a bomb had fallen in the playground and had blown a great lump out of one of the wings of the school. I mean, so that was that. And we were sent home again.
How much fear did the Reds create?
Fear?
Yes.
I saw no evidence of fear. I mean, a degree of nervousness, of course. But people came out. I can remember standing in my home, on the doorsteps of my home in central Edinburgh, right in the middle of Edinburgh, you know, looking up and looking for where this Zeppelin was supposed to be.
Was there any sense of indignation or outrage?
Very violent indignation, I can tell you. I mean, this was bringing the war to right on our own doorstep, and we didn't like it. And Scots people don't like their doorsteps to be invaded.
Was there any feeling that the authorities were not doing sufficient to protect you from the bombing?
No. There was no no anti sort of where were the aircraft, because there were very few aircraft, of course, in those days. No, it was accepted that this was a part of this new modern war that we were suffering.
What about your diet during the war? Did you suffer from lack of proper food?
No. Well, there were always shortages. There would be a shortage of possibly of somebody was short of sugar, and the word would go round that the co-op in Morrison Street had got a supply in, and you went round and joined the queue. Or you might be short on something else. But there were shortages, but no, nothing. You know, you had to, your parents did. But there was always a good supply of fish. And also during the war, I was living a good deal at that time up in on Speyside. That is in the village in Aberlour, which is one of the whiskey villages of on Speyside. And there, of course, you had plenty of fish from the Spey, trout, sea trout. You had rabbits, hares, you know, that sort of thing. Plenty of, there was no great shortage up there from big farming country, you see.
What about the labour situation in the First World War as you remember it from the point of view of strikes and industrial disputes? Did they die out or did they actually occur?
I can't remember any strikes or anything like that, or any. I can remember the girls and young women in the munition factories, but I can't remember any. I personally can't remember any industrial disputes.
What do you remember about the women going to the munitions factories?
Well, so they were. A lot of them joined, you know, went to work, you know, making shells and all sorts of things like that. And of course, in those days, it was quite a novelty to see women in trousers, which was the first thing, of course, they had to wear. And they had their hair all tied back. But of course, you see, money. They were earning very, very good money. Working in the factories, in the munition factories.
Was it readily accepted that women should wear trousers, or were people?
Well, it was regarded as a bit of a novelty, but it was realised that, of course, they were doing an exceptional job, and that this was a question of protection.
Now, can you tell me how you yourself came to nearly go to war yourself at the end of the First World War?
How
did you nearly go to war yourself in 1918? Can you tell me what you were telling me earlier? Can you repeat it? About how you nearly went to war yourself in 1918?
Well, in 1918, while I was still in my last year at school... I was a sergeant in the OTC, and I went. I was in November of 1918. I was naturally expecting to be called up in the spring when I reached the age of 18 and had finished school, and I went up to Edinburgh Castle again for a second course. With the Scottish command, and we were there. I was there on the Esplanade on the 11th of November, 1918, when the Maroons went off, heralding the armistice. Well. To people of my age, the group of us there, this was a relief. I think that is how the way, great relief, that we now knew that we were generally had an expectation of life longer than possibly a few matter of months, and that we would not be likely to be called upon to face the horrors that our elder brothers and elder schoolmates had undergone in France and Gallipoli and Palestine and elsewhere. It was a matter of relief. It wasn't a question of that one was afraid. Years ago you'd given up any thoughts. You didn't think in those terms. when you were sort of 16, 17, 18, and approaching going into the services. But you were resigned. You knew you were going, more or less certainly, some of us went in the Air Force in those days, the new RAF, but most of us were destined for the Army. And you knew what that was going to be. So when the armistice came, it certainly was a relief to the young men of my generation, of my time, of 18-year-olds.
What were the scenes in Edinburgh on the 11th of November?
Well, as I say, I was with at the Scottish Command School of Instruction, where all the company were men from practically every Scottish regiment you could name, all NCOs, lance corporals, corporals, a few sergeants, who had served in the trenches in France and had come home for a refresher course, chiefly to knock them into shape, back to remind them again, you know, of the nuts and bolts of army life, of drilling, of detailing and movements to a squad, to a company. And what they were really searching for was to train lance corporals and corporals into sergeants, because they were getting mighty short of experienced sergeants in France at that time. Well, these men, who knew what they were going back to, they'd already had several years of it in most cases, you could imagine. They they just went raving mad. I can always remember that more or less myself and my five companions from my school OTC were left more or less standing in the middle of the Esplanade while all these regular troops just disappeared into the pubs of the high street in Edinburgh. Oh, believe me, it was the biggest monumental, united, unanimous drunk that Edinburgh has ever seen, I think.
So there are lots of people drunk and disorderly on the street?
No. People, they paraded. There were parades up and down Princes Street. But it was jollification. There was no ill feeling. Nobody. I mean, people had done enough fighting elsewhere. They weren't going to fight back home when it was all over. They were merely out for jollification.
So there was no hooliganism?
Never. There was no, there was no hooliganism whatsoever. There was a lot of, you know, singing, parading, and dancing, and a monumental amount of, of course, of putting away of the crater.
Putting away of the what?
The crater.
What's that?
Whiskey.
We read in the history books that the period of 1919 was a very disturbed period socially. Did you see anything of that in Edinburgh?
Well, now, I had just started in 1919, October. I finished my school career in the July, and in the October, 6th of October, 1919, I entered the offices of the Scotsman newspaper to start my career as a newspaper man on the staff of the Edinburgh Evening Dispatch. One of the two local evening papers.
But did you see any kind of disturbances in Edinburgh in 1919?
No. I mean, there were shortages. men were coming back out of the forces, of course, wanting, looking for jobs. Students were coming back to pick up their university careers again. Already a great many of the men who had been medical students had been brought back from France and had been attending medical classes, wearing their uniforms. But no disturbances, anything like that.
Can I jump ahead a long way now into the 1930s?
Yes.
When Mosley was conducting his campaigns,
yes,
political campaigns in Britain,
yeah,
with his new party.
Yes.
Did you see anything of that campaign and the disturbances that sometimes occurred when it was going on?
Well, I didn't go down to the East End, where most of the trouble was down in the East End, round Cable Street, and you know, down there where the Mosleyites went to hold their meetings. That's where most of the actual disturbances took place. I wasn't there, but I can remember I think it was at Olympia, where either Olympia or Earl's Court, where Mosley held a very big mass meeting indoors, and there was a lot of trouble at that meeting. But one meeting I attended, it must be in 1934 in Hyde Park, where there was a great confrontation between the black shirts, the Mosleyites, and the people, you know, their opposition, the people who were very bitterly opposed to them. And this demonstration took place in Hyde Park, alongside more or less, you know, where the up towards Marble Arch and alongside the Park Lane there, on the big open space there, and you had on one side the opposition and on the near side here, nearest to Park Lane, ranks of these black shirts. And I can remember Mosley standing on this lorry addressing this huge mob. And of course a lot of people there had turned up to see what was going to happen, because they were expecting this great confrontation of these two to cause, well,